number 251 in Spanish. That's 250, 50. I should know this. 51. 251. 251. Yo soy golf spiritual leader. Mi amigo. Jefe. Tim O'Connor. The big cheese. I've been to Mexico a long time, my friend. Long time.
I can tell. You mean just slide just so effortlessly, seamlessly Spanish.
I speak a lot of Spanish. I'm not going to lie to you. I think I've mentioned this to you before. I'm a... at the beginning of my Spanish odyssey, I would say I was a 36 handicap, you know, because I had dabbled in it. Like, I've been coming to Mexico a long time. When I lived in Los Angeles in the mid-1980s, I dated a woman that lived in Mexico City. And so I spent some time down there, from here, it's up there. And I learned lots of what I call, like, bullshit Spanish. I could just say hi, and I could say a few things. Like a lot of people when they've tried golf as a kid, right? Then later in life, they start taking some lessons, you know, and they find out that golf's, you know, maybe not as easy as they thought, more challenging, but also rewarding. And, you know, I started off as a 36 handicap in Spanish about a year ago. And as I think I mentioned to you, now I'm a solid 34, 33 on a good day. No, I'm kidding.
More credit
than no.
That.
Every once in a while, I'll dip down in the mid-20s. Anyway, I'm having a great time. I'm here for a couple more weeks. How are you? I understand the weather in Toronto. And I know you're not an advocate of winter golf because of the planet and such. But I understand the weather. Like, we're recording this on March 14th. Yesterday in Toronto, it was 17 to 20 degrees.
Oh, it's been beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Yeah, today it was dipped down to in Guelph here, 45 minutes west of the Big Smoke, about 2 degrees. You know, light wind, and it's good air to breathe. But I can't deny that when you're walking and it's 17 degrees and the sun's on your back, feels damn good. And it's making everybody excited about the upcoming golf season. Yeah. So, you know, people are doing the thing, getting their clubs re-gripped. You know, the demand for lessons at Golf House with me is going up. I add almost like a new couple of clients every week. And so, you know, people are really champing at the bit to get out there.
And again, I'm not sure. I do so many shows these days. I can't remember if you and I talked about this or if Fred and I talked about it. But there's always been some courses opening somewhere in March in the GTA.
Oh, absolutely.
Just maybe not this early. I got some pictures from some of my golf nerds yesterday at some course in Cambridge. And I showed my brother, because we were golfing here yesterday. And I showed him, I said, this is Toronto, or the Toronto area.
Yeah.
In March. And it didn't look like there was, like, it wasn't winter golf. It looked like it was summer golf.
Yeah, well, part of the... what's gone on is, as anyone who lives in this area knows, it's been a super mild winter. I was talking with Greg Pacenti, the director of operations at Blue Springs, and he says there's no frost in the ground.
That's right. It hasn't frozen.
And it's not wet. So he says that you could take a cart, like number 8 at Blue Springs is usually the soggiest fairway at the course because it's kind of down low and all that. He says you could take a cart out there right fine now.
Not only is it the soggiest hole, it's one of the hardest holes at that golf course. It just is. It's a hole that you have to hit a great drive. You can't hit a good drive. You got to hit a great drive. And even if you do, it's a challenging second shot. But if you hit an okay drive, you're too far left, or you maybe neck it a bit and you're further back. That second shot's bananas.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can't miss it left because you're in the trees and stuff. Yeah. And if you miss it right, you're down in the valley so low. Oh, and there's a front bunker. Oh, and I almost forgot. There's a cliff that goes about 100 feet down behind the green.
Well, wait a second. And right off, too far right off the tee, you're in the water.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we get too far into this program, let's let's not forget. Oh, there's the theme again. Let's not forget this show is brought to you by TaylorMade Golf. We're about to officially kick off season 9. Is this winter stuff? It's just us, I don't know, playing around. This isn't the official Swing Thoughts episodes. These are just kind of like the, this is us like doing, I don't know, like it's not new material. Like we're just riffing so that we get in shape for the season that starts in April. But for the 9th year, we're pleased to have TaylorMade Golf, TaylorMadeGolf.ca. Everyone's going to be playing the new QI10 drivers, and I got fit in December. I can't wait to try this new club. You know, I will tell you one thing. Like, the driver from the Stealth to the QI, you're going to notice a little bit of a difference. I guarantee you, if you've never played a TaylorMade driver before and you try the QI10, it's going to blow your mind. Where I was really impressed were the fairway woods. Like, there's something else. More forgiveness means more long and straight drives, even on off-center strikes. The days of missing the fairway are numbered. Get ready to experience your drives in 10K with the all-new QI10 at TaylorMadeGolf.ca.
I kind of miss forgiveness, but there you go.
And we have another sponsor too, do we not, Timothy?
Thank you. Keep us on track. Oscar Bravo, pleased that we're affiliated with those good folks for a second year in a row. Oscar Bravo, makers of the most incredible golf shirt you will ever see or wear. They only make 100 of each polo per year, and made out of fine Italian fabric. And as I say, it feels amazing, and you look swell.
Yeah, I've been wearing them a lot down here, and do you want to know why? Because the Howman, GSL. So, I'm sorry, I'm so dumb. Like, I think I'm so ridiculous sometimes that I make myself laugh. When I call myself
That's healthy.
It is. When the Howman, the Mexican Howman, is different than golfer Howman up north. Here's how he differs. I wear a wide-brimmed hat, which I would never wear. Pardon me?
Yep. I've seen you in it. You look dashing.
So when I send videos to friends of mine like you, you'll see me in my wide-brimmed hat. Plus, I wear the OBs because I don't tuck my shirt in down here. And they look great untucked.
They do. They're that perfect length.
I'm sorry. I thought for a second there that was going to be more of a revelation to you. Can you still hear me? Are you still hearing this?
I've worn them untucked. I've had that experience.
Yeah,
not tucked in. I'm a rebel. I can be a maverick too.
No, I know you can't. I never wear them untucked up north. I don't know why. I just think like a couple times. Actually, not true. A couple times on men's night at Glen Cairn, I wore it untucked, and I got so much shit from the guys. They're like, "What are you doing? Oh, is it casual Fridays?" I'm like, "Ah, shut up. It's just untucked."
Yeah. Oh, it's crazy. most of the noise is in my own head around stuff like that. It's just like, okay, is this really what I should be doing? What would Dad think?
That's right.
What would Mr. Windsor, the head pro at Sunnydale, think? Would I get a strip torn off me for that? Hey, son, get that thing tucked in.
You know, that's so true. I, my dad, your father, that generation of men were so, especially around the game of golf, I think they were so etiquette oriented.
Oh my God.
My father made sure, and I'm sure your dad did too, he made sure I understood where to stand, you know, what the vibe was around, how people play. Things like, you know, taking your clubs to the tee side of the green so that when you walk off, you don't have to go back. Because I don't know about you, but when I play with somebody who doesn't know some of those things, That to me is more egregious than whether you can play golf or not. That's the whole thing. I don't care if you shoot 120, but if you do it quickly and you know where to stand and you know how to take the flag out and et cetera, then you're a joy to play with.
Absolutely. You can tell that sound. I feel like such a silver spoon born with. How's that for syntax?
Okay, Yoda. a silver spoon born with, I am.
Exactly. I feel like one of those boys. Because I grew up at a private course, Sunningdale in London. But you can tell the difference between people who had that experience and versus those who don't. And those who don't are not as aware of those little things that you speak of, sir. Things like you see a piece of a candy wrapper on the ground, you pick it up, you know? And when you're holding the flag, if there's a little bit of breeze and the flag's going wappa, 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 mm-hmm. you just put your hand over it.
Put your hand on the flag, exactly.
A couple of years ago, the captain at the time of Blue Springs, I'm in a foursome with him and somebody's putting, and he's holding the flag out. And wappa, wappa, wappa goes. And I went, Pete, little caddy tip. Just put your hand there and it's all nice and quiet.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's just little things like that. But also when you talk about egregious, it's those, when guys stand on your line and you're putting, and because, you know, they're inside, their marker's inside, and they want to see the thing. It's like, I used to just say, oh, I don't want to be a dick and ask him to move. Now I went, you know what, Pete, can you move?
Yeah, that's the quintessential difference between you and I. I don't think I've ever uttered the phrase, I don't want to be a dick. I just can't help it being a dick. you know, it's funny, things like that. Like, if you're in a cart and we're together and we're coming up to my ball, why would you ever drive on the left hand side? Why would you drive where the cart's situated behind the golfer? Things like that. My brother and I played yesterday, and I love my brother. He's a great guy. He loves the game, loves this podcast.
Is there a butt coming?
Yeah. There was a moment toward the end of the round yesterday, and it was cart paths only. The course I play is getting ready for a PGA Americas event next week. So this is the Latin American Tour and the Canadian Tour have combined. Mm-hmm. And the PGA Tour is calling it the PGA Americas. So we're going to go and watch the guys play a little bit. So they're closed the course, or basically shut. So he's cart paths only. I don't know why I gave you all that other information, but in case you're interested. So we're on the cart path. We're on the cart. And he doesn't know where his ball is. And he walks about 60 yards across from the cart path to the far side of the fairway without a golf club. And I felt so much like my dad, because both he, myself, and his girlfriend are yelling at him, take a club, you know, take it. Because it's like, I understand you don't know where your ball is, but you're eventually going to find it, or you're not. But you know, you got to come all the way back to the cart and go all the way back there. Again, it's a small thing, but those are the kind of things that not him, he's a joy to play with, but those are the kind of things, as you say, if you don't really know them, you know, it can kind of make the round a little bit different.
Well, speaking of small things, I remember, you know, I'm well into my 30s. I'm a young man. You could say.
Oh, I thought you meant now you're well into your 30s. I'm like, wow, dude, you might want to go see a doctor about this.
Yeah, exactly.
Because if you're in your 30s, there's something going on with your skin. Okay, so when you were in your 30s.
I'm playing golf with my dad. We go to Sunningdale. And I just remember one time I get in the car. He goes, didn't get too close to your razor this morning, did you?
Wow.
Like, I hadn't shaved. Oh, my God. Talk about, you know, a mortal sin against the gods of golf.
I'm sorry. Was this the 1830s? So let's move on. Tim O'Connor, of course, with us. Coach Tim with us. Like he's a guest on my show. Tim's with us today. And I see here, Mr. O'Connor. Now, before the show, just so everyone knows how we do this, we had a conversation, very brief, about, you know, a couple things we might want to talk about. I told Tim I had a couple things I wanted to bring up. And then I said, oh, and by the way, I want to talk about your book. And I said, what's the name of it? And I wrote it down. I know. It's called Quiet Mind Golf. And then there's some other words that went along with it. And I wish people could see this on camera, but I'll just show you. Do you see all that stuff right there?
The scrawling?
Do you recognize any of that? Because I wrote it down 20 minutes ago.
I saw the what looks like maybe a five.
Yeah, okay. So the Quiet Mind Golf, you can see, pardon me, it says five essential practices, free Dean golf nerds. Is that close?
Did you suffer a hand injury in grade two that prevents you from
five essential free deliveries for golf nine?
Yeah, DoorDash or Uber or no? It's I haven't quite narrowed it down. Five or six essential practices for deep golf nerds.
Deep golf nerds. Okay.
There you go.
And Tim's got, like, we've been talking about this book now for a while. I've had a chance to peruse it, and I'm looking forward to when this comes out. But in the meantime, what Tim has done, and I think it's a great idea, is you're going to release kind of a little preview of the book, and this is what we're talking about today. Five essential practices for deep golf nerds. I thought we would explore, you pick one. What are one of the essential? How about do this? Tell us the five, and I'll ask you about one of them.
Let's see. From memory, meditation, journaling, recording your three best shots. But what I mean is your three best golf experiences from around. Keeping a gratitude journal. And writing out why you play golf.
Okay, you had two journals there, so I shouldn't have put you on the spot. I just thought maybe you'd have it open somewhere.
No, it's, that's cool.
So those are the five essential practices. So rather than me ask about one of them, what do you think is the, if you were to talk to somebody in some of your coaching sessions, what is the first thing you have people do?
Well, when people start to work with me, I will generally get them to write out why I play golf, because I want to, for people to reflect on what's really important to them about the game and their experience and learn more about themselves. I mean, if you ask, I mean, I've done all kinds of workshops and you say, like, why do you play golf? And people go, well, I'm competitive. I like to be outside. I like to get exercise. I want to lower my index. I want to see if I can break a scoring barrier. And all of that is, that's generally what golfers say, but it's my experience that that's just sort of like the top level. It's almost like eagle level. But when you do this exercise, it's kind of a free writing exercise. And what I find that what happens is that people kind of drop down below their ego mind and they get kind of more into the subconscious. And they might, for sake of example, remember playing golf with their dad in an evening and the sun was slanting in and they just looked over at their dad and went, this is amazing. I love this. I love being with my dad. Mm-hmm. Or a time they're playing with some buddies, you know, and they're juniors, and somebody hits a stupid shot, and you just laugh your ass off and fall down laughing or something. Or, you know, anything else. Or you found yourself somewhere, like, you know, I remember a couple times playing in Ireland and just being, like, on a cliff, something like looking over the Irish Sea and just going, like, oh, my God. This is incredible.
But if I may, Coach, if I may, like, those are reasons that those are things that you loved about the experience mm-hmm. of golf. But correct me or maybe articulate. So that would be somebody's the reasons I play golf or for some of those moments that mm-hmm. golf gives me.
Yep.
But that doesn't have to be everybody. I mean, those are some of the many reasons that a lot of
that's
us.
That's kind
play.
Of what came up for me. I mean,
yeah,
that's,
for
that's
sure,
my personal experience.
No, I get it now, and I love those.
Well, it's all of that. I mean, what's a reason I love to play golf? Because I love the feeling of a purely hit ball.
Yeah,
I love the fact of hitting a shot and just looking up and you see it in that little window.
Absolutely.
And, or, you know, playing mountain golf and seeing how the ball just freezes against the mountain, you know, or making a putt and everybody goes bananas.
Yeah.
That's all fun stuff. It's all of that. Again, that's fun stuff.
I'm just pausing to ruminate and take it all in. I think for me and a lot of people, again, all those are, I have many of those myself, starting with my dad. But I think for me and a lot of people, one of the many reasons, like, you know, I've done that exercise with you and I've done it on my own. And what I think attracts a lot of people to the game, for good and for bad, is the idea of trying to solve the puzzle. And I've used that analogy on this show and I've used it in my dealings with people. You know, the thing that attracts us is the, I want to use this because it's such a great quick. It's one of those things I read. Quixote. It's from Don Quixote. My brother.
Oh, yeah.
It's the chasing, the tilting at windmills. It's the,
yep,
the chase. It's the solving of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
Nature of golf and the fact that it's unsolvable. I'm going to look that up. Quixotics.
A mountain with no top. The unmasterable.
Yes.
The game it is. You can't master.
Quixotics. You see, that's funny. I can't pronounce it.
Well, you have to hit the little...
Oh, it's quixotic. There it is.
Quixotic. Yeah.
There it is. Quixotic. Idealistic, unrealistic, and impractical. But it's the idealistic, it's the quixotic nature of golf where we go to golf. And what I want to say, this is kind of a segue into what I wanted to get into today a little bit with you. Because golfers of all levels have this nature, it's part of what attracts us, trying to solve golf. So that's the good. It's a puzzle you'll never find all the pieces to. The mm-hmm. bad, which is what this show, if you think about it, the foundation of the program, the mental side of golf, is all about dealing with the fact that because of its nature of unsolvability, not sure if that's a word, it's so frustrating. it's what frustrates people, until they listen to 250 episodes of the show and they find out that there is no solving of golf. And it's the idea that you think you should be able to solve it, which gives people the frustration in their everyday life. We've said this 1,000 different ways. How many times have you heard people say, "Oh man, you should have seen how I was driving it on the weekend." And my joke is, the weekend was a long time ago. Man, I was really putting great yesterday. Et cetera, all to indicate that golfers think there's a point where you solve the puzzle. And that's what I wanted to talk a little bit about today. What do you think about that, Yoda?
Well, it's interesting. So the name of the exercise is Why I Play Golf. Like, there's the perpendicular pronoun, I. So I would say lots of people play golf. Why they play golf is the unsolvability of it, like what you do. But I wouldn't say that's everybody.
Mm.
You know,
sorry.
Go for it.
No, please. I know. Actually, tell me about the people that what percentage of people are playing golf with absolutely no idea or no notion of wanting to get better at it. And not even get better at it.
They want to get better, but they don't. But solving it is something like they've got a curiosity that's going to make them look in some books. They're going to seek some information. They're going to practice something. They're going to experience what's going on with them. It's my experience. There's some people who don't want that. They just want to have things handed to them, and this is going to fix what's going on. This is going to make them a better player. And there are people like that, for sure.
Yeah, there are. And I'm going to just sort of I have to interject. I disagree respectfully. I think if you're a golfer, forget about looking in a book or taking a lesson. If you go to a golf course with any regularity, even my buddy Fred, who plays, I'm going to say he plays 10 to 14 times a summer. But every time he goes, he reports to me after, man, I forgot that thing you told me about putting, or I was doing this thing, not chipping. So even, like, I think, I don't want you to misunderstand me. I'm not saying everyone's like me. Trust me, I know that. Thank goodness, because no one would ever get anything done. They'd be practicing their golf swing too much. But I think I think the nature of the game, even at the most casual level, has that nature of a curiosity about trying to improve. Now, maybe not at the level, of our swing thought listeners, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll grant you that there's a sort of, if you'd say a sort of a universal experience, it's generally that we want to play this game, we want to get better, we want to solve the mystery of how do I get the ball airborne, how do I get it to go where I'm going. But I think for each person, there is an eye. There's certain things about the game that really push them forward and why they play this game. And I think unless you know what those things are, it's too easy to get knocked off course into other things.
I totally agree.
Particularly because you get absorbed into this golf culture that we talk about.
Totally agree.
You know, and I just see, like, it happens. I blogged about it last week that it seems to be primarily men. We had George Durrani on a long time, one of my Mankind Project colleagues from, we had him years ago. He said that men seek comfort and control. So you've got something in the golf swing that they don't like, a shot that they want to get rid of. So they go, again, talking in generalities, you go to YouTube and find the problem, find the fix. And historically, it doesn't really get sucked into this golf universe, and it kind of spits them out. And it's,
yeah, I totally agree. And kind of where, and I didn't want to get bogged down, because you're right. When people write down why I play golf, it's not just to get better. It was all those other things. And what I wanted to talk about, one of the things I wanted to address, is the quixotic nature of the game for basically the people that are listening to this show.
Well, now that we can say that word,
I can't stop saying it now. It's so cool. So, so aside from the the resonance, the beautiful green spaces, the conviviality, what I kind of wanted to segue to, and there's a couple things, is the golfers that think they can solve golf. George's notion, which is a great one, that men seek comfort in control. Absolutely. But I believe men and women who seek control of golf are often led to frustration because of the nature of the game, the unsolvable nature of the game. And this is kind of where I wanted to take you on this little bit of a journey, is the notion that better players and the very best players have solved it somehow. I don't think people would believe how many swing thoughts or things that are working for a few days or things that good golfers are doing, because I don't know about you, I've played enough golf with you, but I have something I'm working on in every round I play. I am pretty sure you do too, whether it's a foundational reminder or whether it's alignment oriented or whether it's an actual thing or motion that I'm trying out at that time. There isn't a round of golf, I'll just say it, there's not a round of golf where that isn't present in my game on my good days and on my bad days. So I'm gonna. There's an addendum to this, but I wanted to see what you thought of that first.
I agree. Most golfers do have something that's holding their attention.
Yes.
Something that they're working towards that they believe is going to lead them further to mastery. Yeah, 100% agree with you.
But here's the thing I wanted to, the point I'm trying to make is to tell people it's okay. It's absolutely natural to have something like that. You know, and I'm not even talking about so much your pre-shot routine. Whatever it is you're working on, and I'm telling you, high level players and tour players all have something. But here's the caveat. What better players are better at doing is going, and we've talked about this a thousand times, but I wanted to bring it up in this manner. We're better at doing this, of crossing over to the play line and swinging. Mm. And I'm, if I may, indulge me, I'm better at doing that than a 10 handicap is. On the range, a 5 handicap, 10 handicap hits it just as good as I do. Their good shots are similar. But when it comes to the golf course, I'm just better at taking my little swing thought before I hit, kind of, you know, bringing it in, kind of reminding myself what I'm doing, finding my target, and then going over on top of the golf ball and just trusting that it'll just be there, or I'll trust that I can make a swing at that moment. And that's what I think is the big gap in better players to not so good players. Not so much the swing, but the ability to make the swing in the moment. That's what I wanted to get your take on.
Yeah, I agree with you there. What I think is at work is belief systems. See, the average golfer, or even the aspiring golfer, like there's a vast difference between your level, where you've been a plus, a scratch. There's a vast difference between, say, the way a 6-7 handicap thinks and the way golfers of your ability thinks. In the same way, there's a vast difference between, say, a 12-15, we're talking men here, and a 6-7. And so much of it comes down to in terms of what people believe about themselves and that the way the world occurs. And so it's really interesting. I've been coaching people who think they have to, we talked about this earlier, that they have to look at the golf ball when they hit it. Otherwise, I might miss it. That's a belief system. So to connect what you were just saying, there's people who think that to do something correctly as they're hitting the golf ball on the golf course, whether competition or not, they got to focus on doing the thing right, whatever it is, you know, turning their left hip or, you know, on and on and on. So I agree with you. But better players also have more, they just have that much more experience. It's like anyone who has achieved any degree of mastery has more awareness. So you have more experience, I would say more awareness, that the more that you would say, you know, when trying to hit a shot, particularly in competition, if you were trying to make sure that you did some technique correctly, you have the awareness and experience that will cause you to self-interfere.
Yeah.
So thus you hit the shot.
You know, as a guy that's, you know, you coach people officially, and I certainly coach a lot of people unofficially, but sometimes when I'm talking to somebody, I would say working with somebody, and you can certainly see this when you play in your Saturday morning group. The longer I see somebody stand over the ball, the worse I know they're about to hit it.
Yeah.
And that includes me, by the way. Like, sometimes I'll show somebody something, or we'll just say, hey, maybe, you know, try this thing, this notion I've just given you. And then they hesitate over the ball. And I go, stop. I said, just get up and hit it. Because you can't ruminate. And we've, and you know, one of the many thousands of things we've said on the show that I think really, really resonated with me, and something that I think would resonate with others is, you, golf is the one thing you can't do while thinking about how to do it.
Agreed.
You can think about how to do it beforehand. Like, I had a bunch of really good shots yesterday. I had another round yesterday where I made like a way above average number of birdies. And I hit some really, really, really good shots. Like, the shots that I woke up this morning thinking, man, that 6-iron, God dang it, it felt great. Like, it was so good. But I had two shots yesterday where I fatted them so badly. I had one, I was like 220 yards, but I had to clear, I had 185 yards to clear the water. And I was a nice hybrid, no problem. Like, if I make contact with it, it's going over the water. I wasn't even thinking about the water, but I was thinking about my little swing thought. And I got up to the golf ball, and I knew I took a second longer, and somewhere in my brain, I just had this notion before I pulled the trigger that, uh-oh. I did. I was like, uh-oh. Because I know the rhythm of my body over the golf ball. Same thing, a couple holes later, I had a simple 8-iron into the green. You know, I was going to, and it was a little, I took too much club. So it was about a half club too much, and I was standing over the ball thinking, this is too much club. That's what I thought. That was my last thought. And it was a total anyway, but the thought, this is too much club, had me do a bunch of things. And I hit this, Timmy, I hit the ball 60 yards. And as soon the divot went, it was one of those ones where the divot went further than the ball. And all I could do was laugh because I immediately knew. I even said out loud, I went, Azra, that was the wrong club. This was what I wanted to do. I'll finish up. We don't have to belabor this, except to say that I don't think people should worry about having a swing thought. It's not that. And by the way, Bobby Jones said this, that he never played a round of golf where he didn't have a swing thought. And there were very many times when he won major championships where they were different. They were just different. He was working on different things.
Yeah. Yeah, I see that 100%.
Again, my point being, sometimes I think people think, well, as soon as I learn this thing, then I will never have to learn anything else about golf again, and I will have it, and I will be, this is my thing. And then 3 weeks later, you're like, what happened to that thing? That thing works so great. And now it's shit. Oh, God, yeah.
Well, we joked. I mean, my dad was so typical. We'd go and visit. How's the kids? Great. How's the job? Great. Okay. How's your golf? And then he'd be standing in the kitchen showing me something. He says, when I pause at the top, oh, man, I'm hitting it great. See him 2 weeks later. When I keep my right knee flat, I hit it great. And then it's always something. And that's just, to me, use that phrase again, universal experience. That's what I find golfers do all the time. And they just flit and fling, lurch from thing to thing to thing. And thus they don't build up any experience with what and learn from it, because they're just flying around all the time. And so, you know, that example you gave a couple weeks ago of watching Poulter, he was getting ready. He had just re-putted or something.
Yeah, he missed a 2-footer.
Yeah, that's right. And you saw him back off his next tee shot.
Yeah.
That's what better players do, because they have a high level of awareness. Because they've been through that a lot. The average golfer misses those signals. It's kind of like you missed the signal that you didn't, that 8-iron wasn't the right club. For some reason, you didn't sort of listen to your body, which was saying to you, abort mission.
That's right. I will say this about the kind of golf I play down here. And I tried to explain this to somebody the other day. You know, my stupid GSL verbosity, just bullshit that comes out of my mouth. The type of golf I play here is different than I play when I'm, it's not that I'm not taking it seriously. I am. I enjoy it. I just don't take it like personally? I want, yeah, I don't, well, I maybe. I like to think that in those two occasions, if I was playing for a score, I would have stopped myself. Because I back off a lot of shots, but down here, it's almost like, you know, we're playing for a couple of reasons. For just the, well, back to the reasons I play. The reasons I play here are different because I'm playing here to enjoy the day and be outside where it's warm. Also to get out of the sun. Like my group yesterday is my brother and my sister-in-law, and she's great. I mean, she played so good yesterday, but we're all about, if we stay out here too long, we're going to die.
We're going to melt.
We're going to melt. Like, it's the type of weather here. It's like, imagine the hottest day in Toronto in the summer. It's like that every day. So when you tee off at, and like, I'm playing tomorrow morning at 7. It's a different vibe when, you know, you're going to be done in a few hours. Whereas yesterday afternoon, like my approach is just to kind of get on with it. I don't circle putts the same way I would at home. You know, I don't consider it the same way. So, but you're right. That's what better players do. Have a bit more of a, they're tuned into like, this doesn't feel right. Even if the lie feels weird, I'll usually back off it.
Yeah. Well, what I wanted to add on that is that when you are in any level of, shall I say, performance, you have more adrenaline. You have, your focus is just better. Like I find in our band, our practices are really good. Our performances are always a level or two higher because it's just, it's more exciting and just everything is just more accentuated. And so I think that better players have more experience in that higher level of the game. And so they're just attuned that much more to subtle things. And the average player, even like, there's such a vast difference, even like I say, between, you know, even a 4, 5, 6 handicap than a scratch. It's just, it's night and day.
Well, that's a great segue, Tim, because I wanted to read you something I read this morning. Because, you know, we often, one of the attractions of golf, I think, is that we watch these guys on TV, or in my case, recently in person, and we think, oh, you know, that's cool. Like, I've hit a shot on the green like that before, or I've holed a chip before, or I've sank a long putt. You know, we've all done that. You know, at our age, we can't really relate anymore to how far, but you and I have both hit 300-yard drives.
With the tailwind and firm conditions.
But we've done it. So I read this morning, and I thought this was so apt as far as how good really good golfers are. You know, like, yeah, I think it's cool that I can shoot even par. I shot even par yesterday.
Oh, nice.
You know, it's cool. But here's this guy tweeted this morning. He says, the PGA Tour lied. These guys aren't good. And he tells this story. He goes, PGA Tour lies. These guys aren't good. Once upon a time, I played some professional golf. I was on a mini tour in the Carolinas on a course I grew up on, played the course hundreds of times. In fact, I shot 65 there before, says this guy. In this mini tour event, I proceeded to play poorly and shot a few over par for 3 days. No big deal. The guy who won, this is a mini tour, he goes, the guy who won shot 61, 64, 65. He tied the course record and beat my very best in hundreds of rounds all 3 days. This was a low-level mini tour event. I was a great player then. It would have taken my very best to finish in the top 10 and get my entry fee back. These guys aren't good. They're skilled beyond what most people can imagine. And I thought, isn't that not only interesting, but isn't that true?
No, it's absolutely true.
I love that phrase, skilled beyond what most of us could imagine.
Yeah, I've been very so fortunate. I mean, I've covered, it was, I think it was 7 or 8 Masters tournaments, been at US Opens, PGAs. And when you see people hit the ball like that, it's just like, it's unfathomable. How's that for a word to pronounce? Just the ball flight, just to the trajectory, the control, the speed, the balance. See, that's the thing that the average golfer just looks at and goes like, he hardly seems to be swinging at all. Like Rory, his swing, like they don't seem to be working very hard and just hammers it 320.
Mm-hmm.
I said, it's because they're so efficient. You know, I don't know if this works, but it's like when I remember playing pickup hockey 10, 12 years ago, and there was guys, it was obvious they played junior, they played, you know, Guelph Storm, CHL level. And I would go out and I'd be exhausted after 30 seconds, go, mm-hmm. go. They would be just gliding around effortlessly on their edges. And so anyone who's at a high level, just there's an efficiency. There's just this innate sense of balance and skill.
Yeah, I love that
they've honed.
No, you're absolutely right. That's a great way of putting it. There's an efficiency to better players' motion. So a bunch of people weighed in on this guy's post, but my favorite was this. He goes, yeah, I was a former PGA player as well, did some mini tour stuff. He said, I remember somebody telling us, you guys are in the top 1% of golfers in the world, but the guys on TV, they're in the top 1% of your 1%. Like, I watched, this will be another segue, I watched a couple episodes of season 2 of the Netflix show, Full Swing. Have you watched it?
Not yet, no. It's not the second season yet.
Yeah, it's okay, you know, it's not, a couple episodes with Rory are pretty interesting, and, you know, it's okay. It's not, I think I said this about the season 1, it's not as good as you kind of hoped it would be, but for golf nerds, it is kind of cool to see the behind-the-scenes stuff. But the one I watched yesterday is called In the Shadows, and it's about Matt Fitzpatrick, like number 10 in the world, and his brother Alex Fitzpatrick, number 708 in the world. And it's about, you know, they're sort of, you know, the young kid, Alex, you know, having to, you know, always be in the shadows of his brother Matt, who's just that much better than he is. But even the 708th player in the world qualified last summer for the British Open, the Open Championship, and then beat his brother, shot 65 in the third round, faded a little bit in the fourth round, finished 17th or something. Matt finished like 40th. So how good is that guy, number 708, who could finish in the top, I think he finished 17th, so top 20 at a major, and yet, if he wasn't Alex's brother, no one would know who he was. So that's how good those guys are.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like you watch guys on the Corn Ferry, and they would look no different than the guys you see on the PGA Tour, except they don't, you know, the guys on the PGA Tour save a half shot here, a half shot there. They just don't fall in their swords very often.
Well, I promise you next week when I go watch these kids from the, you know, the Latin American tour, the Canadian tour, you know, obviously the first thing I'm going to do, I like to go to the range and watch them warm up. And I know the golf course pretty well. I've played it from the back tees. So I'm going to watch them play a few holes and just see, you know, because, you know, if you, they're just so, like you said, that word efficient. They're so good. And they're not even as good as this kid who we'd never have heard about, who finished 17th in a major. Like, there might be some kids this week that are definitely as good a ball strikers. But what is it if you're the 4,000th best player in the world? There'll be some guys there next week. They're ranked in the top few thousand.
Yeah.
But like that guy said, the 1% of the 1% is Scottie Scheffler.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Because I coach the University of Guelph golf team, I know of some young men, I won't name their names, who could play pretty well at that, you know, university level up here. And so they went, oh, I'll take my shot at pro. So they go down and they get a place in Florida or something like that. And life becomes really hard. And I just think that I just put it down to this. This is my little, maybe it's just trite, but I think that if you're, to try the pro level, I think that generally you should be able to fall out of bed when you're age 15 and shoot 65, like with nothing.
Yeah, I agree.
You haven't even had a coffee yet that day. Mm-hmm. You didn't break a sweat and you shot 65. And because you've played at this level where you've just developed your skill and you're able to access this natural talent, you don't overthink things, but you've just been in the fray of competition. At 17, you've had, you know, anywhere from 200 to 1,000 people watch you settle over a 3-foot downhill putt to win a tournament.
You know, I was going to say another way of putting that was if you haven't been identified as special at a very early age in any sport, but particularly golf. It's the rare It's the rare kid you hear about, man or woman, who took up the game as a 13 or 14 year old. Like, there was, I think it's a young, I want to say Rosie Zhang, but one of those, somebody that turned pro, I remember remarking to myself that they'd only been playing for 6 or 7 years, but that's an outlier. All those other, you described it perfectly. Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth, there's that famous picture of them as 11-year-olds playing in the World Golf Championships or something. You know what I mean? Like, they were identified very early on.
No, that may have been that, you know, it might have been, you could have done what Larry Nelson did years ago. I think you might have. So Larry Nelson was in the Army. He came out, didn't know what he wanted to do. Oh, let's play golf. So he gets a bunch of golf magazines and he learns how to play golf.
Yeah.
And Larry Nelson ended up being a top player. Maybe 30, 40 years ago, that was occasionally possible.
Yeah, but that was because that's the exception. That doesn't prove the rule. It's just the exception to it.
Exactly. But I'm not sure that happens as much now. There's just that many more people coveting spots, whether it be, you know, on an NCAA Division I team. And it's just, it's like hockey now. I mean, if you, you know, if you haven't largely been playing AAA hockey since you were peewee, then good luck.
Yeah, you got to be special.
Even
early.
If you lead, even if you win the scoring championship, you know, for the Brandon Wheat Kings or something, you just, the road to the top is so hard. Like, it's just so hard.
Speaking of the top, let's finish off with this. This is the last thing I wanted to throw at you. And, you know, we've talked quite a bit the last couple of years. Obviously, at first, we were a bit reticent to jump into the live thing. But now it's you can't not. It's undeniable. It's part of the sport. And there's the, I don't know what you want to call it, a controversy or the discussion around official world golf rankings. But this week is the Players' Championship. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, it's been touted as the deepest field in the game, you know, and winning the Players' Championship is actually harder than winning the Masters, because the Masters has half the field and a bunch of old guys that show up.
Yeah.
But what do you think about, because they still say it's the, you know, the best field in golf, and that's just not true anymore.
I agree with you 1,000%.
Well, that's pretty good.
We're at a space in golf that's just confused, muddled. We're in this trough trying to figure this shit out, how we go forward. And so an unfortunate consequence of that is you're not seeing the best players in the world, you know, and the Players Championship, I agree with again completely, that always had, they make the argument, the best field. You can't even argue that about the U.S. Open because of the qualifiers. Guys can get on a heater, you know, even like some head pro from Podunk somewhere. Ooh, there he is in the U.S. Open. Whereas everyone in the Players has earned their way through, you know, a really hard criteria.
Like, traditionally, they were able to say that for those reasons that you mentioned. And how the qualification process worked was harder, more arduous, and based on an official world golf ranking that we all agreed. The problem with that now is that doesn't include Cam Smith, John Rahm, Bryson DeChambeau, Brooks Koepka, Patrick Reed, even though you don't like him, he's a good golfer, and on and on. So there's six or seven, I'm leaving somebody out, but there's a lot of guys in that cohort I just mentioned that would be in the Players' Championship. I think Mike Weir, Joaquin Niemann, I think Mike Weir, now that I thought of it, made a mistake by not allowing live players onto his President's Cup team. Because why not? Like, Joaquin Niemann would have been a pretty good addition to that squad.
Yep, I agree with you, but was that a, so?
Well, I mean, probably not up to Mike. Listen, it's not Mike's.
Yeah,
they made a mistake not having those guys play. I mean, the upside for us Canadians, there'll be more Canadians on it, and I think most of them would have qualified anyway. But there's a few guys on the LIV Tour that would have been nice to have on that tour.
Yeah,
on
exactly.
That team.
On the international team. Well, It's interesting is that Liv finally just flew the white flag on the whole rankings thing. They just gave up on it. They say, okay, it's done. We're not going to change this. And but I still agree with it. You know, the limited feels 54 hole events. That's just not the same, you know, as 72 hole events. So it's just, I don't know how it winds its way through. And, you know, here it is, interesting, you know, week by week, there's someone throw something out there. Monahan went out and did his, the commissioner Monahan of the PGA Tour said hardly anything. And actually, he was kind of upset that there's lots of questions being asked. Duh.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then Rory saying that, yeah, limited fields are okay. And of course, then there's, you know, guys who are not as highly ranked push back. It's like every week there's this, you know, it becomes messier and muddier all the time.
Well, you said it, that the sport is definitely at a, I was going to use the word, a sort of an inflection point, a point where, you know, there's no doubt about it that Liv has made the PGA Tour weaker, and it's just kind of fractured the game, because I would like to watch John Rahm. I left Dustin Johnson out of that. John Rahm, mm-hmm. Dustin Johnson, Brooks Koepka, Cam Smith. I'd like to watch them play golf, but I'm not really drawn to the Live format. I mean, I've poked in it a little bit. I want to see them play 72 hole events. I just do. Well, there you go. That's a lot of show. We gave the people a lot of show today.
We ran through a number of different things. Tick, tick, tick.
And forget about Quiet Mind Golf, 5 essential free deliveries. 5 essential practices for deep golf nerds. Right here, our guest has been Tim O'Connor and golf spiritual leader. Live from the Swing Thoughts Theater, everybody.
Yeah, the Swing Thoughts Theater. I love looking at you with a kitchen behind you. You got, you know, the silver fridge, the nice cupboards there. The, you see the water, microwave. Oh, one banana.
You want to see something that will make you laugh? Want to see something? Okay, sure. Watch. So I'm going to tilt my camera so that Tim can see what I'm surrounded by. Because I tried to make it more soundproof. Look at this. Say, hang on. See, that's a...
Oh, yeah.
So I'm surrounded by... They're basically lounge cushions. But I've surrounded myself on 360 degrees so that the sound doesn't bounce off all the walls.
What an audio expert veteran you are.
Yes.
I mean, we've all been in restaurants where there's nothing but hard surfaces and someone's 2 feet away and you can't hear them.
So there you go. Swing Thoughts, episode 251, brought to you by TaylorMade Golf, TaylorMadeGolf.ca. Don't forget to try out the, and this is the year. If you've been waiting around, like, when should I try the new TaylorMade stuff? Now's the time to do it. Go get it. I can't wait. I'm a couple weeks away from picking up my new QI10. You can find out more at TaylorMadeGolf.ca. I've almost called you Fred. Fred, tell us about who's our other sponsor, my friend?
Oscar Bravo. Kind of like who's the most interesting man? What's the most interesting shirt you could get? Oscar Bravo.
And until just next time, yes.
I'm getting fitted next week at TaylorMade.
Okay. Well, listen, the next time we talk, I think will be my last week in Mexico. Until then, thanks for listening. Tim O'Connor, O'ConnorGolf.ca, and of course, the program produced by The Humble and Fred Show, humbleandfredradio.com. Double fall time. You feel all right when you hear the music ring.